This is CICK News. As of January 31st, BC's three-year pilot project decriminalizing small amounts of illegal drugs will come to an end. The province says enforcement practices won't change, but critics argue that the policy failed to deliver meaningful treatment access or clear guidance on the ground. I reached out to the RCMP for comment, but they were not making themselves available to speak to me by my deadline. I was able to speak with Skeena MLA and official opposition critic for mental health, addictions, and housing supports, MLA Clara Tay, about what the end of decriminalization means for northern communities, concerns around stigma and public safety, and what her party says is needed next to address the toxic drug crisis, particularly in the north. I pressed MLA Ratay to give me concrete examples, as the opposition party has been highly critical of the decriminalization project. Apologies for the sound quality of this interview. The phone call that I used, I had technical issues, and MLA Ratay had to call me back on a phone that didn't have great reception.
I'm the MLA for Skeena and the official opposition critic for mental health, addiction, and housing supports.
Okay. So could we just start off January 31st? It'll be the end of the decriminalization program. What are your thoughts on the end of this program?
Just because this pilot project is ending, there were no clear guidelines from the ministry or the government as to what that effectively changes on the ground. They're not making any changes to the way that law enforcement handles it. They're not making any changes to the way first responders handle anything, those working within mental health and addiction. The only announcement that they had to pair with any of this was the expansion of a phone line that already last year was announced as it was supposed to be then available to anyone in the province, and it evidently was not. So now they've expanded that so it's available to anyone in the province at some point in this year. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I did want to actually touch on some of those points with you. Is your party, are you concerned with how this will need to increase police intervention in communities for people who are in possession of 2.5 grams of substance or lower?
I don't think this is going to change anything effectively on the ground with the way that law enforcement handles simple possession charges for personal use. This pilot project, law enforcement was already using their discretion in these cases. That's been going on for a very long time. It's been well understood for a long time that substance use and addiction problems are a health issue. And obviously there needs to be discretion used, because if it crosses that boundary of it being simply a health issue and it crosses into a public safety issue, that's when discretion should be used. But the problem with the way that this experiment was rolled out was effectively the outcome from this experiment was just normalizing drug use in public and almost encouraging it, normalizing it, and disincentivizing recovery and treatment. And that was the problem I had with this from the beginning. Law enforcement was already very capable and was exercising that in using their judgment on a case-by-case basis. That this was not necessary if that was the intent behind this pilot. That's what they're claiming now, is this was to incentivize treatment and to normalize that and to remove any criminal element to getting help and to make sure that people didn't feel scared to reach out for help. But treatment was never criminalized. It's the exact opposite. And I know that because I've lived through it. In 2011, I went to treatment for a drug problem, because I knew at that point in my life I was struggling and that going to treatment was the only option available to me that actually removed any element of criminality and any element of me being at risk of hurting myself, of death. It's just such a false premise, because that was never the reason behind it.
And is your position as critic for mental health, addictions, and obviously housing supports? We know how obviously those three go hand in hand, because if you don't have a safe place to be, to live, that you have this constant stress of your life of what the next day is going to look like, what today is even going to look like. So for your party then, and honestly, if you don't want to talk too much about your experience, but what about voluntary versus involuntary care? How is your party going to work with this announcement and then pivot to suggest a treatment that your party can actually stand behind and that you yourself stand behind?
Yeah, for sure. I'm never uncomfortable talking about my experiences. And so for me, when you're looking at voluntary versus involuntary treatment, the biggest distinction here is that we still have many British Columbians, thousands of British Columbians that want to access treatment voluntarily that haven't been able to because of long wait lists, because there's not enough investment in publicly funded beds. Even the ones that are publicly funded aren't funded at 100% of the rate. It varies from health authority to health authority, but in some cases, they're only being funded to about 50 to 70% of what the actual cost is. So the providers have to prioritize private pay clients to be able to just keep the doors open. So we're in a situation right now where not only do we have thousands of British Columbians that voluntarily would like to access treatment, but because this problem has gotten so out of hand that they have to pivot to involuntary treatment. They really have no choice left in the matter simply because we're seeing everywhere that there are more and more people that are permanently brain injured, that are struggling with severe mental health challenges on top of the fact that they have a substance use problem. Our mental health system has been incredibly far behind what we need it to be. We do not have universal healthcare access because we do not have universal access to mental health support. That's why involuntary treatment has become so necessary at this point.
And I realize that obviously too, that this is more than this is obviously more than just a toxic drug or even a supply issue. That's obviously at the heart of a lot of these deaths here. But one thing that I did want to just to press you about was how then your government will address the importance of community addiction services, but also when we're looking at care facilities, whether they're voluntary or involuntary, we know that the North is overrun and a lot of people, these are some public health nurses or social workers, and then also people that I've spoken to who, when they are suffering a mental health addiction and they've experienced an overdose, what happens is that they're actually taken out of the community so often. And I am speaking to you from Smithers, that they're taken out of the community and typically they go to Prince George, but that it's so important to still stay grounded in community. So with your experience, what would your party then suggest as a way to actually continue and even support a grounding in your community rather than being removed? And then a lot of times people come back, but their community hasn't changed, but they have. How would you address that?
Yeah, so I would say the first part of it is the premise I don't necessarily agree with, because I think I'm a really good example of why I couldn't stay in my community. I was going back and forth between the downtown east side and Surrey when I was in the height of my addiction. And I made the choice after leaving treatment, I actually made the choice before I entered treatment, that I was going to be moving up north once I was done. And that's what I did. And I created a life for myself here in Kitimat. And I genuinely do believe that if I had stayed in the Lower Mainland, there's a good likelihood that treatment wouldn't have worked for me. And that's not to say I moved up here magically. I wasn't surrounded by people that were using drugs or partying or whatever, triggers, all of these things. It's not that it was just so much easier. I didn't have my family around. There was a lot of factors that made it difficult, but I knew that I needed to be somewhere different. I needed to start fresh. That was just what I needed. Everyone's experience is going to be different. So I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think that is important to remember, because sometimes staying in community can be detrimental. We do know that, as you mentioned at the end of that there, what you could go back to your community and you've changed, but your community hasn't. And so sometimes it can actually be detrimental. But that is very much so on a case-by-case basis. So I think we need to be able to have flexibility and to have options for people and to be able to determine what is going to best serve them. And I think that really does vary case by case and community by community. But beyond that, disproportionately, even though we have a smaller population because we're not identified, we're disproportionately more affected by these issues. We have issues with homelessness, for example, at twice or more the rate that urban centers do. And that's based on data, that's based on the government's own data. We know that you're almost twice as likely to be homeless living up north here than you are living in an urban center. So It's difficult because those investments need to be made and we need to catch up. But I understand also that the government is dealing with an issue of exploding population growth in urban centers. And so they're trying to catch up there as well. So it would really be about looking at overall budgets and figuring out how we can make sure the money is getting allocated to the places that it needs to be. And that starts with trying to ensure that we're not spending on things that don't need to be spent on. There are solutions here. I have raised many of them, and I have many more that I will continue to raise throughout my time in this work. But there needs to be a willingness from government to listen and to work with both sides of the house. And at this point, I have not seen that.
Okay. Could you give me some of those concrete solutions that you are raising when you're in legislature? What are some of those concrete ones, especially ones that really address the crisis here in the North?
Certainly, yeah. So the first one is just a lack of availability. It's a lack of investment into treatment beds. We just don't have them. So we need to get treatment centers up here. I know there are a number of excellent treatment centers that are operating already in other parts of the province that have approached me that would be so happy to open treatment centers up here in the North. They would love to do that. They want to do it. But again, the government's saying, sorry, we have no money. We can't help. And unfortunately, the reality is most people that need access treatment can't afford to pay privately. They just can't. So it's also looking at those other intermediary stages like sober living facilities. When we look at what's going on with supportive housing in this province, it's absolutely astonishing. It's mind-blowing to see how they are handling this. We know already that investing in things like sober living facilities as an intermediary stage after treatment is infinitely more effective in ensuring that people are less likely to relapse. Why wouldn't we make those investments? So making that investment rather than having to put them through treatment 2, 3, 4 more times, it's a simple no-brainer, but the government does not look at long-term solutions. There are a lot of different concrete solutions here. But again, if the government's not willing to listen, then all I can do is just keep trying. But at this point, I've not been successful in getting them to recognize that there are a lot of really valuable solutions out there that in the long term would actually cost far less money for the government. If that's what it's going to come down to, if it's going to come down to just a simple dollars and cents, there is a way to do it, but they're just not willing to.
Okay. Emily Rutate, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Of course, happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
As BC's decriminalization pilot for small amounts of illegal drugs comes to an end, public health officials are being asked to assess what the policy changed, particularly for people who use substances in northern and rural communities. In the Skeena and Northwest regions, barrier to care, limited anonymity, and ongoing toxicity in the unregulated drug supply continue to shape overdose risk. I spoke with Dr. Jong Kim, Chief Medical Officer with Northern Health, about whether decriminalization reduced stigma, what health risks concern him most as possession becomes criminalized again, and which harm reduction measures have proven most effective in the North. Here's that interview now.
Hi, my name is Jong Kim. I'm Chief Medical Health Officer with Northern Health.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Kim, for taking the time to speak with me. I'd like to start right in. From a public health perspective, what effects did decriminalization have on stigma for people who use substances in the Skeena region, particularly in smaller or rural communities where services and anonymity are pretty much limited?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I think that the decriminalization, one of the key intention is that acknowledging that addiction is a health issue and the stigma and that it's important part of barrier to access, and by separating people from the criminal justice system to increase access to care they need and support they need. From what we have been seeing and experiencing during the pilot period, that those intended outcomes have not been kind of delivered. So we are continue to focus on those measures that we know it works and save lives there. So in terms of stigma, during the period that we've seen and what we hope to achieve with the destigmatization, we have not seen that the reduction and the lowering barriers through the decriminalization that we can hope for there. It is important to note that some of that purchasing and acquisition practice and behavior is different in some of the smaller community compared to urban communities, including how they are accessing and possessing drugs. So it's important that we are aware and we continue to support that those kind of measures that kind of save lives there.
Many communities feel like there is still a stigma around even checking that your drugs are safe, which really is, it's such a vital step now, for more recreational users, just with so many variances with extremely toxic and deadly substances that are just being found in so many of the drugs that are within our communities. So with possession of small amounts becoming criminalized again. And just for reference for our listeners, decriminalization was for 2.5 grams or less of an illegal substance was not a criminal amount to possess anymore. But with these small amounts becoming criminalized again, Dr. Kim, what health risks concern you most? And I guess it's for this, I'm referring maybe to people going back to more solitary drug use practices indoors and the potential impact on overdose prevention sites in Northern BC.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that it's important to note that unregulated drug poisoning continues to be a significant emergency, like in the North and including Northwest communities. And the important part of that is, as you've kind of noted, that the toxic contamination of the kind of drugs and drug supplies there. The main thing we are focusing on is those intention that we try to achieve through the decriminalization and other measures continue to be important, that we are lowering barriers and connecting people with the necessary care. And those kind of services that protect people from the toxicity of that, some of the contaminated drug supply, including kind of drug checking, providing the support and connections that they can safely consume the service, consume when they do, for example, through the overdose prevention services, as well as connecting when they need and when they seek that they get necessary care and treatments, including mental substance use, will continue to be really important.
But Northern communities already face barriers like limited access to supervised consumption, detox, and treatment services. So in your professional opinion, how does recriminalization intersect with the gaps in services that I mentioned? And then what does that mean for health outcomes in this region?
I think that this will be part of our continued kind of evolve and kind of focused approach to what works in our emergency kind of situations in our response. We are focusing on the measures that it hasn't shown to be effective there. For the Northern Health side, like we ensure and continue to work on increasing and sustaining those kind of access to treatments and harm reduction and services, and continue to support our community partners that provide really important necessary services in our community, and also work in a broader partnership, like including like RCMP, which we understand that taking the measures approach with the change in the decriminalization kind of policy.
I did reach out to RCMP as well to have them speak on this topic, but at this time they cannot make any comment. But Dr. Kim, I do wonder, and if I can just press on just one thing that you said, what measures have been the most effective in the North?
There are key measures like we've seen some of the kind of changes made. I think this continued to be important. Naloxone and increasing and expanding access and availability of naloxone. We've seen that in the overdose prevention services we provided, that how it actually prevents some of the high risk kind of situations and make a difference like right away, saving the life as well as reducing a potential harmful effect from the toxicity of the kind of drug supplies. Drug checking continued to be important, both for that providing important tool for individuals that they can use to aware and approach their consumption of the practice of the drug, as well as providing the community and healthcare providers to be aware what are the toxicity of drug supply, allow us to share the information and be respond to those kind of situations. And mental health substance use, including overdose agonist treatments, continue to be quite effective and make a huge difference how much risk a person might be at. And we also really seen that when people that unfortunately die from that toxicity of that unregulated drug, it's usually when they are alone, using it alone or not connected, so that those measures connecting them into some kind of social connections and care and network has continued to be an important part of our response.
So I spoke with Emily Claire Rattay. And one thing that her party are, they've basically labeled involuntary care as the primary response to the end of decriminalization and I guess just the toxic drug overdose epidemic in the province. What's Northern Health's take on a measure of something like involuntary care for people who are obviously suffering from addiction and and that being an approach.
I think that the overall, that any kind of individual measures, it's a part of that collection of the response we do in connection to each other, and really focusing on those people and the family and the community, and how do we actually support address health issues of those person, and particularly for the Northerners, how do we support those health issues through the health care that we can provide and connect when they need and those kind of cares. So those particular measures, we look, listen closely to some of the kind of the experts, subject matter experts kind of discussions, and some of the guidance recommendation coming out. And we also look for when public policy and directions, as well as some of the resource kind of support is coming out. And we will ensure that those collection and the package of the response that we will implement to support these health, significant health situations.
I understand. Was there anything that I didn't ask about the effects of the end of decriminalization or Northern Health? Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you think is important to include in this conversation?
Just acknowledging that we continue to have significant emergency and deaths from this unregulated drug poisoning, and we grieve those kind of loss of lives we are having, that, and also that appreciation and gratitude of that the families and communities and those partners really working and supporting in these emergencies. And we will continue to work in response to these emergencies and doing what works. That we've seen the differences being made to the community members and providers and community partners through including harm reduction treatments and kind of supportive environments.
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, Dr. Kim, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No, Nero, thank you so much. This is an important matter. So really appreciate that kind of reaching out and get able to have this conversation in support of our community.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague, Dan Messick, and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.